This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 17th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus.
Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's show dedicated to the world of design. Coming up today, just in time for Christmas, we'll get sparkly at a new exhibition looking at some of Cartier's best ever creations in Paris.
There are more than 600 Cartier creations together with 300 documents from our archive and documentation departments. So it makes this exhibition one of a kind. No other exhibition in the 20 last years has happened like that.
We explore the mystery of Turkey's lost pavilion.
What is interesting is how this pavilion has ended up being a part of these fragmented histories of Turkey and Cyprus. When they restored the Sistine Chapel, or as they restore artworks, they remove layers of dirt and grime from these things. And you're actually erasing history.
And then we'll stay with architecture when we find out what effect the built environment can have on our health and well-being.
Light-filled, accessible, easy to understand, warm without being kind of excessively warm. We want it to feel like it hugs you.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Dazzling tiaras, diamond-encrusted handbags, magnificent clocks and precious objects belonging to kings, queens, maharajas and socialites of their day. These are just some of the remarkable pieces currently on display at the Grand Palais in central Paris, all of them creations of the Paris jeweller Cartier. The retrospective, Cartier, Style and History, is the most important exhibition ever to be dedicated to the jewellery house. Monocle's Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson, went along to the opening day of the show and then headed to Cartier's flagship store on Rue de la Paix in the heart of the French capital. There he met Pierre Raniero, Cartier's director of Image, Style and Heritage.
I think it's very important because it shows the specific aspect of Cartier creation, which is about style. It shows that a house of jewelry has a specific style since its very beginning, and it's very distinctive and probably not as well known as for other artists.
What sort of things are on display?
The number of exhibits is very impressive because there are more than 600 Cartier creations together with 300 documents from our archive and documentation departments. So it makes this exhibition one of a kind. No other exhibition in the 20 last years has happened like that.
What sort of things might we look out for? What to you are some of the highlights of the whole exhibition?
Oh, there are different points of views different ways of looking at the exhibition, because you have the exhibition is organized in different sections, each of them showing a different aspect of a creation of Cartier. So each of the sections is worth seeing, of course, and looking at. But I think at least there are two important windows. One is dedicated to the tiaras, the first platinum tiaras ever created at the very beginning of the 20th century in what we call the neoclassical style, called now the garland style, and this window is really, really incredible. And there's a second window, which is not to be missed, is a window entirely dedicated to mystery clocks. Mystery clocks are a Cartier invention, and they are called mystery clocks because the hands are like floating in a block of rock crystal without any apparent link between the hands and the movement, and they are really, really chef d'oeuvre, as we say in French, and not to be missed.
And so royalty have been a big part of Cartier's history, kings and queens who've ordered their tiaras and other ornaments and so on. Who are some of the other icons of Cartier over the decades, do you think?
I think there's a very important point about Cartier, because since the creations show a very daring style, because Cartier has always been very creative in a very specific way, and the creations of Cartier have been adopted by women, especially women, with a very independent and strong character. And I think it's the common point of all these important clients throughout the history of Cartier, and especially at the time of what is called now the Café Society. Café Society stands for a social life, including at the time in the salon, the artists that were welcomed for the very first time in society. And it means that within that those circles between Paris, London, Venice, and New York sometimes, I think the creation and the statement of your own character and your own style through jewelry was very, very important. And Cartier was the main supplier to those very important women. Important because they were trendsetters and they opened the doors to the behaviors of the women of today.
And some of those women have a special place in this exhibition. Tell us a little bit about who some of those people were, the really iconic women of the day who've been so important to the brand and perhaps endorsing the brand of Cartier.
Everything starts with queens, of course, and there's a window entirely devoted to Mary of Romania, the Queen of Romania, in the 1910s and 20s. And one of the most important stone exhibited is the blue sapphire of 478 carats that Cartier sold to her, and she was wearing as a pendant. And there's a very important portrait of her of that time, showing her wearing the Cartier jewelry. And then all the way through the exhibition, you have women, for very important women, for each period from the 20s, 30s, 40s until the 70s. Not to be missed, of course, I think Marjorie Mary Weber-Post, very important American client who had incredible collection of Cartier jewelry, but also Daisy Fellows, or also Liz Taylor, the Duchess of Windsor, and of course Grace Kelly, for instance.
Yeah, some very glamorous clients over the years. Have client demands changed notably, say, in the last 15, 20 years? Are the sorts of things people are ordering markedly different from perhaps during that Café Society era?
I think the main point today is really the freedom of expression. I think if there's a point to really enhance today and to see as a very distinctive is the freedom that nowadays women do enjoy. And I think that there are a lot of different pieces that are ordered because effectively those women that we mentioned in the past open the doors to them today, and the possibilities are total today. And we can have very daring pieces, such as we saw in the exhibition, crocodiles, panthers, as far as figurative jewelry is concerned. But you have also a new kind of femininity expressed. And even if the style and is the same, we produce, for instance, Tutti Frutti pieces. Tutti Frutti stands for, you know, the Indian-inspired jewelry at Cartier, mixing the different colors of stones like emerald, rubies, and sapphire with carved stones. And today we produce that kind of pieces, but in a very different way. The structure of the pieces of jewelry is very subtle, very much articulated, fluid, and probably, I say, because we are not into sociology at that stage, but probably expressing a very serene kind of femininity today.
That was Monocle's man in Paris, Tom Burgess Watson, speaking to Pierre Raniero of Cartier. And that exhibition of magnificent Cartier creations is on at the Grand Palais in Paris, running until the 16th of February. After the break, we head to Lisbon, where one exhibition is attempting to unmap the world. No small task. Don't go away.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. As part of Lisbon's three-month-long Experimenta Design Biennale, an international group of architects and designers are taking part in a curious exhibition that attempts to unmap the world. A visual interrogation of all things cartographic, real and imaginary, Unmapping the World showcases a series of design-led reactions to contemporary map-making practices. Saima Tarek takes an exploratory tour with co-curator Nuno Coelho.
We are looking at designers not only as technicians. I don't want them call us mere technicians, but not as someone that would translate any information into a visual display or a visual object. We were looking for designers that were engaged with the subject that they're talking about, so they could create something visual, but they were producing their own content. And for us, it's very important showing the work of designers, but also architects and artists. They are contaminated by the subjects that they're talking about.
Nuno Coelho is talking to me on the upper floor of Lisbon's Tropical Research Institute, a building surrounded by the lush botanical gardens of Belém. The former site of Portugal's Cartography Commission, this 19th century palacio has a long history of mapping out the country's empires, hosting the finds brought back to these shores during colonial times. With work by 22 participants, Unmapping the World walks the visitor through a sometimes overwhelming array of contemporary responses to the idea of map-making. Femke Herregraven's online computer game Taxodus, for example, allows you to play the role of a CEO hunting for tax haven locations. Rosemarine Palland's series of rugs are produced by local craftspeople depicting their own territories based on images lifted from Google Earth. Nuno and co-curator Annelies de Wet have gathered together research projects that create a dialogue with the site through astute exhibition design.
When we first visited this place, there was another exhibition here, but all the windows were closed and you could even see the tiles. And for us, the building was amazing. So that's why we decided to clear the space of everything. We just left 19th century cabinets. And also we wanted to dissolve the boundaries between what is actually from the exhibition and what's actually from the building. So when you look at something, you can't really tell. So it's about more transparency and blurring borders. This is one of the gems of this building, which is a xylotech. A xylotech is a library of woods. So what we have here is small samples of wood that came from all over the world. When the Cartography Commission was exploring the inland of Africa, they were taking samples of every single wood they're finding. So what we're presenting here, at this room where all these samples are got together, it's a work by a collective called Super Sudaka. And Super Sudaka, they're based in 80 different countries, but they work mostly through the internet. And what they're presenting here is a self-commissioned project they're doing. You can see the dummy of the book. The book is not yet finished. And they're mapping the impact of mass tourism in the Caribbean. So all the postcards that you see, it's not supposed to take, but to look at the pictures. And these pictures taken on those Caribbean islands. But you won't see any touristic pictures. You see more the hidden Caribbean side. And they're collecting lots of curious stories, like, for example, the fact that there was an island in the Caribbean that tourists got very disappointed because there was no palm trees. So the government decided to plant palm trees to make that country became more real.
The interplay between site and show is effective in counterposing the impartiality of fixed geographical representation. For example, posters of collected news media maps of chemical weapons sites in Iraq in 2002 are hung next to two others of similar purpose in Syria and Iran. Notebooks designed from the patterns of the world's border fences sit on school desks in the same room. The leaps made between design practice and the idea of boundaries, geographical, personal, and virtual, make for dense, if sometimes jumpy, curation. A striking project is Ruben Pater's installation comprising hybrid flags and a typographically stunning publication about piracy on the seas. It explores how seafarers between 2010 and 2012 have used flags to circumvent the rules of the ocean. A proposition for a world expo in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2020, envisioned graphically by graduates of Amsterdam's Sandberg Institute, takes the exhibition into imaginary realms.
All projects in this exhibition, no one asked someone to produce it. It was the contributors themselves that self-initiated this project. there's a possibility of this exhibition to travel. Well, Experimenta is doing a design biennale in São Paulo next year, in 2014. Besides that, I think analysts as well, but we want to further research into the creation of maps with contemporary practices. So if not this exhibition, I will definitely dive into map making even more.
Unmapping the World is a poetic exploration into territory in all its forms. It is clear that the participating designers will continue to interrogate the idea of a map as fact, as well as artifact, in future projects. Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tarek.
Thanks, Saima. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Coming up, we explore the mystery of Turkey's lost pavilion and look to London's skyline and ask where good design and human well-being meet. But first, it's time for the weekly roundup of some of the big stories with a guest from a region on our radar. Let's cross to Hong Kong, where Ed Ng, co-creator of design firm AB Concepts, who specialise in the hotel and hospitality industry, is on hand to talk Asia at large.
I think the first thing that come across my mind is, you know, I'm working on a project in Beijing, because obviously, like after the Olympic boom of like hotel scene in 2008, I'm seeing that there's another big booming in the next year. Actually, it's starting probably this week. Like in Beijing, suddenly there will be Waldorf Astoria opening by Glenn and George. Mm-hmm. And then next year, remember there's a fire for the CCTV building that's supposed to be Mandarin Oriental. Mm-hmm. Actually, they will open it next year. And then the Rosewood will be opening as well. And then also the project, the W Hotel that we're working on, is also opening in mid of next year. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like a post-Olympic boom over there.
And can you try and sum up what is the sort of any design trends in how these hotels look?
I think because they all done in a, I would say, in a much more sophisticated and much more it's in a more high design way. I think it's not so much the China with the, I know what, how the Western always looking at China, oh, you have a lot of like this motifs and lattice work, maybe a certain color scheme that you would expect it, but pretty much from what I see, so it's totally different. Yeah, it's more towards the clean line. Yeah, and then it's gonna be something not, I mean, you feel it's China, but it's not the literal way, yeah, as what you would expect. Yeah, so it's exciting, yeah.
I mean, China obviously continues to boom, almost incessantly. There is a sort of been a real rise of the second and third tier cities in the country. How have you seen, you know, architecturally, how are these cities developing in your eyes?
Well, that's actually a very valid question, because, well, let's first talk about all the focus we are talking about on this second and third tier city. I think because now they all getting to have a lot of spending power, and then so what do they go for the weekend? And then, and maybe you don't know that in the old days in China, they have only like some mega holidays, like they call the golden weeks. So they get off from the office for 7 days, 10 days. So then they all have this big holidays. So now they tend to have the smaller holidays, and then putting together this like high speed train travels. So that's why that brings all the people going there. I mean, with a very easy way, you can spend a weekend just outskirts of Shanghai or even to this kind of what we call the second and third tier cities. Mm. Yeah.
And how have you sort of felt developers or architects are kind of keeping up with this? As people travel more, how are they doing it? Are they sort of, obviously there's a lot of kind of cheap mass housing. Is that kind of changing? Is that developing?
Well, I think it's actually because a lot of our friends in China now, they are well traveled. Mm-hmm. If they have longer vacation, they know what is a good hotel. Yeah, so now you would, you wouldn't expect like, oh, in the 30th city maybe something very, very stripped down. No, sorry. It's really like sometimes you would just be blown away by, wow, how could you have such a wonderful hotel in a 30th city? Mm. Yeah. So I think because they even need more attraction, more talking point to bring this like a new destinations. Yeah. So it's all about PR, marketing, and so as a designer and architect, this is something we are excited to see. And because especially for this exotic locations, usually they have a very deep cultural or maybe a scenery attraction behind the city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And talking of traveling, I mean, you go to working quite a lot in Bangkok, don't you? Which is, I mean, obviously a slightly tense political situation there at the moment, but it has kind of really emerged as a real sort of creative and design hub, which we've covered a lot in Monocle. What's the scene like there from your perspective?
Well, I think tourism is always, you can always associate that with Bangkok in general or in Thailand. A lot of people actually ask, hey, Ed, why are you rather to set up your office in Bangkok but not like Shanghai or Beijing? But because I actually feel that because the more I spend the time in Bangkok, the more I notice there the design education, for example, Silipakorn and this great university has a very sophisticated design educations. And I think in general, Thai people, I would say if you ask me the difference between Hong Kong and Bangkok, I would say Hong Kong is, I would use one word, is spontaneous, but Bangkok is experimental. Yeah. Also, the culture is accepting a lot of new ideas, and they really willing to experiment. And then also, as I said, the more time I spend there, I noticed they have a lot of like beautiful crafts, like the way they do the bronze, the metal carving, and all this timber works, and not to mention the textile is amazing, and which has been one of, it's a really amazing resources behind our Hong Kong office and help us to look at a lot of these exotic materials. And sorry, it's so much, once we talk about Bangkok, there's so many topics I can talk about it. And then because also, you know, obviously, you know, Mima is like this another hotcake now. So Bangkok is just the neighborhood across the, like with only like 1 hour flight away. Yeah. So this also like Bangkok, you can really support the anything around that region from Mima to Indonesia to Singapore, and all around the region is so much in the proximity.
AB Concepts founder Ed Ng rounding up the week's design news from Hong Kong. We'll be back after this short break to ask what impact building design can have on your health.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Welcome back. When master planning our cities, the designing of buildings forces architects to ask what good design can do for our well-being. What impact does design have on our health? Isabel Kaiser went along to the Royal Institute of British Architects in London to find out how a well-designed building can affect our life, well-being and happiness.
As somebody who deals with controversial buildings all the time, I am bound to say that I found the approach to architecture and the environment around the architecture to be second to none.
That's one of London's top planning lawyers, Russell Harris QC, chairing a panel discussion on how to balance good health with good design. In light of a new development for British charity Maggie's Cancer Care Centres, architects, designers and property developers have gathered in London's RIBA to discuss the practical reality central to this debate. One of the panelists, Lily Chenks, from the architecture firm Chenks Squared and daughter of Maggie, has this to say when I asked her about teaming up with architect Zaha Hadid for a project.
We have a quite interesting brief in that we have the things that we want to accomplish in the building. We'll have a site and we'll have a general sense of the square footage we need, but we're much less prescriptive than most clients because what we're really keen in doing is giving the architects a sense of the type of atmosphere and the experience we want to create in a building. Light-filled, accessible, easy to understand, warm without being kind of excessively warm. We want it to feel like it hugs you, but if you want to get away and you don't want to talk to everyone in the building, you want to be able to find nooks and crannies where you can sit and curl up with a book and not have to talk to anyone. So we give a brief that's quite open and allows the architects to come up with their particular way of responding to creating an atmosphere and an emotional response to a building. And when we commissioned a Maggie Centre, I think, you know, there are many things that we try and take into account. Partly it's a reaction to what we don't want to do, which is to create institutional buildings. We want to create buildings that address the individual and the human and the person. Hospitals and health environments are places where we go through some of the most important transformations in our life, from birth, sickness and death. And we need buildings that help us address those situations as humans and as individuals rather than as numbers. And I think that the Maggie Centres, we're lucky, we're a privately funded organisation. We have the ability to help bring some humanity to healthcare.
Next, I speak to Russell Harris QC, not only an expert on planning and environmental work, but also involved in the development of many of the tall buildings in London, including the Shard.
Well, the Shard was a very specific project, a very tall building, the tallest in Western Europe. One of the main issues was the objection by English Heritage, who believed that it would harm the London skyline and also harm the Tower of London, for example. So my job was to persuade the inspector that the quality of the building was such that it could coexist and live with those other much older buildings, the best of the new with the best of the old.
Is well-being something considered during the legal planning process?
Well-being is, but not in as precise a way as it would be when you're developing something like a hospital. So it's really on the tangent of most planning decisions, and it's reflected in the sustainability objectives that all buildings now have to meet.
So how does the Shard do in terms of the criteria set out by tonight's discussion?
I think it did pretty well, but in a different way. I mean, these are buildings for treating people and ensure people's health is engaged with, whereas the Shard looks differently, with a different use and a different agenda. But bearing in mind that both buildings are meant to be as sustainable as they can be, the Shard is sustainable, this is sustainable in a different way.
From the not uncontentious skyscrapers of London, we turn to the stones, smells and hillsides of Wales. Biba Dow from Dow Jones Architects is one of the masterminds behind the new Maggie Centre in Cardiff. Biba tells me about how they plan to include the surrounding nature into the design of the new centre.
Our building makes an enclosure, which is a wall in a clearing made of Pennant sandstone. And then we've lined it with cedar boarding, inspired by the cedar trees on the site, which mark the thresholds and points of the garden. And also we formed the roof lights out of ocolux, which has a copper interlayer, so that it responds to the rusting of the sandstone and the autumn colours of the bracken on the hillside that you see from the building.
Absolutely fascinating that the walls will be smelling of the forest.
Yes. Being able to respond to the material presence of buildings is very important and very an important part of how architecture and materials ground spaces. And so the idea that the building will be fragrant is something we're very excited by.
This is on entering. This is a view across the courtyard where you see...
Although one can't expect this kind of integration in all new developments, when it comes to health, there are some architects willing to place well-being at the center of the design process.
What's interesting about this is the capacity...
From Monocle in London, I'm Isabel Kreiser.
...to capture light and to push
the... The world's fairs remain long in the global memory. When structures like the Eiffel Tower are built and entire cities are replanned and rebuilt for such fairs, the words lost, forgotten and missing aren't usually the first words that come to mind. But when Dr. Johan Pillai, a Sri Lankan-born academic living in Cyprus, was approached by the Turkish ambassador to display some large blue mosaic panels, he soon realised, much to the surprise of the Turkish embassy, that the mosaic panels were remnants of Turkey's revolutionary pavilion at the 1958 World's Fair in Brussels. And as Dr. Pillai's research took him deeper into the mystery of the panels, he learned that the entire pavilion had essentially disappeared. But as he found traces of it, the story of the traces became as interesting as the pavilion itself.
As the opening date of the Brussels World's Fair nears, the elaborate pavilions of the 48 nations taking part are rushed to completion. America's building, the world's largest...
Well, in 1958, there was a World's Fair in Brussels, and each country represented itself with a building which showcased their architecture. And Turkey was an emerging republic at the time, so what they did was essentially put together a pavilion which had really no ethnic connotations. It reflected modern Turkey. It was composed of two buildings, one representing Europe, modern Turkey, and the new capital, Ankara, and the other representing Asia, the former Ottoman Empire, and the old capital, Istanbul. And these two buildings were linked by a 60-meter double-sided mosaic wall made by one of the most famous Turkish artists, Bedri Rahmi Eyvoglu. To give you a sense of scale, the wall in the pavilion was actually 60 meters long, and these mosaics went on either side of it. So each panel is 2.27 meters high, and about half a meter wide. And the images vary from scenes of Anatolian life, such as folk dancing, shepherds with sacrificial lambs, a stylized map of Istanbul and major mosques and historic sites in Istanbul and the shores of the Bosphorus. There are different colored stones which were imported from Italy. The Turkish government paid a tremendous amount for this in 1957. And these large slabs of stone were brought in, and 12 students and artists worked day and night for a year to cut them into about 1 million shapes, which were then assembled on tracings of the designs, and these were sent to Brussels, where they were set in fiber cement. Most of the artworks that were in the pavilion were done by some of the most famous artists in Turkey. And essentially, the building was designed to be disassembled and brought back to Turkey, and they were all sent back by train. But when they arrived in Turkey, shortly after they came out of customs, there was a military coup, and the entire prefabricated building in numbered packages was thrown into a park next to the train station, where it stayed for 19 years, and different people, including municipality officials and the police, basically looted it. There was an entire building disappeared, together with everything in it. In one case, about 20 panels were found in a branch of the municipality dealing with garbage trucks, and they were hidden under cement bags in a shack that was made of glass and aluminium from the pavilion, and where they used to wash the garbage trucks. Some we know are perhaps still in homes in Istanbul, and we have managed to trace the remainder, about 175 to 180 panels, which were actually taken to Cyprus in 1960. The reason why they went to Cyprus was that in 1960, on the 16th of August, a new republic had been formed, and about 5 weeks later, they had decided to have a trade fair. We know from the person who actually took them to Cyprus, he was a trade representative of the Ministry of Economy and Trade, he contacted a businessman who had apparently taken these panels from the park and had them in his basement. And so we know the mosaic panels were taken there by airplane. They were assembled within a week. And the pavilion in Cyprus then featured this, most of the same mosaics that had been on the pavilion in Brussels. About a year later, we know the Turkish ambassador took some to his summer residence. The colonel of the Turkish regiment in Cyprus, the Turkish military command, asked permission from the ambassador to decorate an army officer's club in the military camp with them. Then in 1963, when the ethnic conflicts started in Cyprus, we know that some of them were used as shields against bullets and grenades to protect the military commander as reinforcements to cover up windows and so on. So a lot of them were destroyed during that period. Then in 1974, with the Turkish intervention in Cyprus, we know that the soldiers built trenches and that they used many of these panels as supports for the trenches. Someone walking along where the trenches used to be found a couple of panels and decided that they were beautiful and would be the headstone of his grave and of his wife's grave. And so we found these tombstones in two different cemeteries. Another piece we found in the garden of an elderly lady. Her family was going through an economic crisis, and she had a dream in which the uncle of Mohammed's aunt appeared to her and told her to start digging in the garden and making a tomb for him. And so she started digging early in the morning and found this piece of colored stone, which she believes has been in Cyprus since the beginning of time, and it's a sacred stone. And so she wouldn't let us take it away. She certainly wouldn't let us photograph it without a great deal of struggle. And that's part of the logic of her life. Had this pavilion come back to Istanbul and been set up as originally planned as an exhibition hall, it would have been just another exhibition hall with another work from the artist. And that would not have been particularly interesting. What is interesting is how this pavilion has ended up being a part of these fragmented histories of Turkey and Cyprus. When they restored the Sistine Chapel, or as they restore artworks, they remove layers of dirt and grime from these things. And part of my argument is that when you remove the dirt and the smoke and all of the things that have accumulated on a work of art, what are you doing? You're actually erasing history, because that dirt is the accumulation of years of observers' breath and cigarette smoke and whatever else has gone into it. So there is an argument for preserving dirt, because dirt is the medium of history.
That was Dr. Johan Pillay recounting the story of Turkey's lost pavilion. The Austrian capital of Vienna is well known for high levels of quality housing provision. But the city's authorities are planning to take it one step further still as they work to manage a rapidly growing population. Seestadt Aspern, a new urban development currently being built on the outskirts of Vienna, is one of the biggest city enlargement projects in the EU. Designed so as to be as self-contained as possible, it will be home to some 20,000 people when it's completed in the year 2028. Our Vienna correspondent, Alexei Korolyov, has more.
It's eerily empty here now, I have to say, but in little more than 20 years' time, this site will change beyond recognition. This promotional video of Seestadt Aspern envisages, and I quote, "a city of tomorrow, with state-of-the-art apartment blocks huddled around a sprawling lake and recreational spaces."
At the heart of Centrope, the new booming economic region. An urban concept for the 21st century.
I think normally all new developments are very strict, are very schematic.
Architect Rudiger Leiner has designed parts of Seestadt Aspern.
And so what we wanted to do is to make a kind of structure or principle that allows to develop social qualities on one hand, so that it's get really kind of living area, and spatial qualities on the other hand, so that it's what we said, we want to make a beautiful city.
The project has been in the pipeline for more than two decades, and with good reason.
The city of Vienna is growing quite rapidly. We have about 18,000 to 20,000 people every year coming to Vienna.
Kurt Hofstetter is a city planner and project manager at Seestadt Aspern.
So it's a big challenge for the city to provide infrastructure, to provide schools, whatever you need for people to live, and of course to provide housing and working space. This is an area that was, for a long time, it was kind of outside Vienna, because it's on the other side, if you may say so, on the other side of the river, the northern part of the Danube. And these areas always have been little villages.
In fact, most of this 240-hectare area here was once occupied by Vienna's first airport and was later used for car races.
So it was a kind of empty field, a very, very huge lost area in a certain way.
Architect Rüdiger Leiner is fascinated by the site's relation to some of Vienna's most famous landmarks.
But you had some very interesting, quite interesting views that you saw the Stephansdom from there, you saw the hills of the Wienerwald. So you had suddenly in this lost area where you think there is no orientation at all, you have some specific points.
And what's unique about Seestadt Aspern is that it's really trying to create a mixed-use city.
Zelia Tillner is an architect who sits on the Seestadt Advisory Council.
It has the idea of the main streets, you know, that locate certain shops. They even have organization that they created that really manages all the retail uses on the ground floor. That's totally unique, as far as I know, the first time in that scale in Vienna.
Tillner also praises the recent extension of Vienna's underground railway system to Seestadt.
And I think that's an incredibly important step, and that should be done in all new development projects, because the biggest mistake that is made quite often, not only in Vienna, everywhere, that you build new areas, you start building a lot of residential projects, people start moving there, and the public transportation lags behind.
But who in fact is going to live here? According to Claudia Nutz, head of Seestadt's chief development company Wien 34 2020, it is aimed at just about everybody.
If you talk about target groups, I think it's important to say how large the development is, because we implement a city for 20,000 people. So you cannot say my target group is just this group or this group. Definitely, it's in the Austrian scale, it's a small town. So it's clear that it should be a place for young people, for elderly people, for rich people, for poorer people.
It is, however, this definition of Seestadt as a town or city in its own right that has drawn criticism.
What irritates me about the Seestadt Aspern is actually that it is a place at the periphery. It is a place that you pass through when you leave Vienna going for Bratislava.
Christian Kuhn, professor of architecture at the Vienna University of Technology, is one of Seestadt's detractors.
And at this very point, it uses a Ringstraßenplan with the idea to create a new center. And I think it should be a vision of a new transitory space between two capital cities. And I'm not sure if it will be very successful to get important office space to the area, because Vienna has to offer a lot more areas closer to the center with more options to sell your offices.
But Nikolaus Zuma, a member of a city hall team overseeing the project, is more optimistic.
I think it can be a very significant part and can contribute to the international profile of the city of Vienna as a business site worth investing, maybe as a smart city worth living, and also as a growing city, as a city that is growing sustainably.
Architect Zilia Tilner hopes that other developers will look to Seestadt for guidance.
I do hope that it sets a precedent, not in terms of its size and its shape, because I think that's hard to copy, because, you know, it was an old airfield site. But I think what is really unique is the very well-coordinated efforts of urban design, of landscape design and public transportation planning.
For Monocle in Vienna, I am Alexei Korolev.
Now, in a sneak preview of what's to come on Monocle 24. All next week and the week after, the Globalist show in the morning is looking back and forecasting ahead through the focus of affairs, business, culture, design and edits. For the design show, airing at 600 hours London time on Thursday, we kick off with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, looking back at the big design stories from 2013. Here's a snippet of what you can expect. We begin with a look at the changes at Artek.
It was quite incredible because I was in Finland a few weeks ago, and that story is still reverberating. And I think on one side, you have a lot of people, you know, really sort of asking these questions. Can Finland sustain this type of business? Why didn't it work out? And as we know, Artek, venerable brand, was owned by Proventus, a private equity company out of Sweden. It gets snatched up by one of the world's most respected companies in the world of design in general. And really, if you look at the commitment that Rolf Feilbaum, the owner and founder, has to architecture and industrial design and urbanism. He's created his own, you know, little world practically. It's quite amazing. And yet, I think, you know, Finland is, you know, in many ways, it's such a closed market, and the Finns are quite special and they're very protective of their brands. And so I think there's still a lot of soul searching. The fact that this company, for all intents and purposes, you know, it's fully Swiss owned. And a big question mark is to, does it even have a future in Finland? Could this just be another brand that migrates to other cities? There's also a huge look that they might move their center of gravity from Helsinki to Berlin, for example.
Yeah. Do you think Artek want to sort of try and keep that Finnishness, which is so much part of Artek and the sort of DNA of the brand? Or
I think they have to, because yes, you want to push the brand forward, but I think there's an opportunity to still be one of those players out of that region. The Japanese like the fact that this is a brand that is from Finland, not that it's something which happens to be designed in Finland and made somewhere else.
Next up, Louis Vuitton, a new man in the hot seat. Yeah, is it much of a surprise that he...
It's not much of a surprise. It's about as surprising that when we heard that Nicolas Ghesquiere was going there, it was almost as surprising as that we heard that Tom Daley was gay. So no, it was amazing to sort of listen and how this unfolded for weeks and weeks and weeks. And we thought we were going to get this official statement. And then finally, you know, it is released. And I think when we look at it on balance, I think it is a good thing. Marc Jacobs, very talented, but I think it was time for him to move on to a new assignment.
And another sort of man in the movement this year, last year, has been Richard Rodgers, who's celebrated.
I'd like to say Richard Spencer Powell, who's been very quiet. He's in the studio. Our creative director is also here as well. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
Rich, your take on Richard Rodgers? Did you get out to see the show early this year?
Unfortunately, I didn't get to see it, but I'm a fan of him, actually. I think he's a very interesting and important figure. And I think what's really nice about celebrating his work is that lots of these sort of star architects that build these things all over the world, not everyone gets to see them. And so I think by housing it in an exhibition, people can come and actually see the work and talk about it. And I think he's been so outspoken about London, and I think rightly so, his battles with Prince Charles. I think it's good for people to look at that work and have a bit of a debate about it, because I think he makes some very valid points about the way you build a city.
Absolutely. Rich, why we wanted to get you in here in particular was to talk about a couple of interesting rebrand subjects which have happened over the past couple of months. First up was the big Sweden renovation, which we've discussed before, but...
I think big...
No, I've got you both.
I think big's maybe the wrong word there. 1 year in the making, and it's the Swedish flag. Interesting. I've done a little bit of research about that after we initially covered it, and I think one of the disappointments there is that the way they announced it was just simply, oh, here's the flag, here's the rebrand, we're either genius or idiots. I can't remember what their quote was. But actually, if you then go to their website and see all the other branding work they've done, it is a bit more expansive than they've actually kind of initially kind of let on. And I don't really know why they did it with such a sort of...
You mean the way they released it, or...?
Yeah, the way they released it. It was
sort of apologetic, wasn't it?
A little bit of a sort of squeaky fart, really. I think they should have announced it and shown more of it, because who knows, it could be really great, but I just think they... yeah, I don't know why they just came out with such a sort of meager offering.
Next up, American Airlines, who early this summer had a bit of a rejig.
Well, they did.
This is
quite remarkable, because I think so many people have long loved American Airlines for the fact that they just have these aluminium, metallic fuselages. They never paint their aircraft. I was not a fan in the very beginning. It was very Captain America. It seemed a little bit sort of too vocal and loud, but I guess with lots of things. I didn't like Finnair in the beginning as well. I liked sort of the sky blue, and then suddenly you had this very sort of dark navy and this massive Finnair down the fuselage. But at least we're seeing some type of graphic innovation on the part of U.S. carriers, because they've been so tired for so long. And I think we only have to look at the last merger between Continental and United, where they just took the Continental tail and they kept the United at the front of the plane, which was just a massive cost savings exercise. And again, I sort of feel not unlike the Swedish rebrand. Rich, I don't know what you think.
I sort of secretly quite like them. I think it's quite a crisp bit of work, actually. Yeah. It's neat. And I think so many Telfins are still quite bland. I mean, it's such a great job to do an aeroplane, and there's quite a few naff ones out there. And
yeah,
I liked it. Punchy.
It has presence as well. I think the other thing you should say, we can say about American too, is that they have ambition on the inside. So they've got a new series of Airbus A321s that they've ordered, which they're going to be flying transcontinental in the United States now with a proper first class. They're introducing flat beds because it's not exactly a short hop between JFK and LAX.
It's Tyler Brulé and Rich Spencer-Powell joining me there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Today's show is produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you have any comments, queries or requests. I'm Tom Morris. And playing you out for a bit of Christmas cheer, here's James Brown with Santa Claus Goes Straight to the Ghetto. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto. Hitch up your reindeer. Go straight to the ghetto. Santa Claus, go straight to the ghetto. Fill every stocking you find. The kids are gonna love you so. Leave a toy.